Well, I'm glad that Steve was the first speaker. So he emphasized the importance of optimization in data mining, data analysis. I know this is a workshop, so there's mixed audience here and people from the biomedical sciences. Sometimes they don't know what's optimization, but I think you got a good flavor now here. We know that in the past, data mining has been mainly in the field of statistics, and but only the last 15, 20 years, optimization gave a lot of contributions here. And defined data mining is nothing else the practice of searching through large amounts of computer data to find useful patterns or trends. This is very important because sometimes you may find things that are not useful, okay? So that's why it is a field that needs many experts from different disciplines. And optimization is nothing else but how to make the process more efficient, okay? So we can define this as numerical optimization. As you see here, Steve discussed support vector machines. They use convex optimization. You know, convex optimization can be solved efficiently in the sense that we have polynomial time algorithms. But also there are some other type of optimization techniques that are not, unfortunately, always solved in polynomial time, as I will show you by an example today on by clustering. So the combination of optimization and good data mining techniques gives us the best way on how to extract meaningful patterns. Of course, as I mentioned, optimization is not always easy, not always convex, okay? Now, support vector machines have been very popular. Why? Because they are convex quadratic programs. We know a lot of duality, and we can do that sort of very efficiently. But sometimes many models can be expressed as discrete optimization problems. Then when we introduce discreteness, things become much more difficult, okay? Now, it's not only advantages optimization that made things much easier to analyze data, but also advances in computer sciences. I will mention here, you can see the hard drive cost, approximately one-tenth cheaper every 5 years. The capacity of hard drive, you see here, approximately 10 times more than 5 years. We should not ignore these developments in computer technology. Processing power, what you can do with a supercomputer 20 years ago, now we can do with a laptop. My laptop has a lot of power as much as a supercomputer many years ago. So a combination of computer technology and optimization techniques really helped in this field of data analysis, especially in biomedicine. Now, we deal with data here. Many people, they say that we have huge amounts of data. We collect a lot of data now from the genome, from many other things. So we have two types of data we try to analyze, massive data sets or sometimes very large data sets. What is the difference between massive and very large? If the data does not fit the memory of your computer, then you have a massive data set. Many times, suppose you have data, it's full of disk data, like in this room here. How do we analyze this data? The new techniques, we have to start thinking about new algorithms and also new computer architectures, okay? The problems become very challenging. And only the last 10 years, people, they start developing what we call external memory algorithms, or semi-external memory algorithms to deal with these problems. Also, new computer architectures, you know, input in parallel, output in parallel. Imagine we have such huge data sets, even searching for an element, sorting, which is always a classical problem data sets, become very challenging because you also have to count the visits each time back and forth to get the data. So data analysis with massive data sets introduces new challenges, and I hope some of the students, the audience here, they start working on these new problems. But classes in computer sciences, only now they start coming out on external memory algorithms. Actually, a few years ago, I was with people in AT&T who analyzed the call graph, huge data sets from, you know, from the call graph, and we used some external memory algorithms. And this motivated us to try to see what's going on in these problems. We have a handbook that published some years ago, handbook of massive data sets. And actually, you won't find many of these books in the literature, okay, because the field now starts evolving. This book addresses many of the data analysis issues when your data set is massive, okay? And also introduces some of the external memory algorithms. For example, find the connected components of a graph. In computer science, theoretically, is a polynomially solvable easily problem. But if you have a massive data set, it becomes a very challenging problem. But here we are not going to deal with massive data sets, okay? Although we have done some work on certain classes of such problems. Here we deal with sums and futures, okay? This talk will focus a little on microarray data, many applications in biomedicine. Sums is a set of a population, can be patients, okay? Futures are the individual measurable properties of the phenomena being observed, can be in genes, depends on what type of application we have, okay? And sometimes we have weights, okay? A weight or height of an individual accounts the expression of the gene, okay? Now, Steve mentioned some of the challenging problems in data mining. Unsupervised clustering. So giving a set of sums, partition them into groups of similar sums according to some similarity criteria. Classification, sometimes it's called supervised clustering. Determine classes of the test sums using known classification of training data set. That's very important in practice because always we know something. We know that something belongs to something, okay? So without the training set, the problems become almost intractable, okay? How can you cluster a data set? Sometimes you don't know if it really can be clustered. Future selection for each of the classes, select a subset of futures responsible for creating the condition corresponding to the class, okay? And of course, data is collected by humans, by machines, and we have a lot of outliers, and filtering of the data is a very difficult problem. Sometimes, in the past, you know, everybody, you know, I worked for many years in data comes from the brain, EEG data, electroencephalograms. The typical filter they used was a Kalman filter. But Kalman filter many times can filter out very useful information, okay? So by removing outliers is not a trivial issue. Do you know what you remove? You may remove useful information, okay? And sometimes also you may have to complete the data, as Steve has shown in the last problem with distances. Maybe it's experimentally very expensive to compute distances. You have a matrix and you have to complete it. And this some very nice actually optimization problem, like the distance, the matrix completion problem, you know. Very nice, but these are practical problems because if you experiment, you compute part of the data, and then you have to complete the data, and you must make sure what you complete is correct, okay? And of course, it's not only the noise that we have to deal with, also dimensionality, the high dimensionality of the data. Many times you have too much data, and we analyze the data for practical purposes, okay? And sometimes you have to visualize things. But we know to visualize things only in dimension 2 and 3. Unless you are very smart and you can see things in dimension 5 or 6, you know. Some people, they can see it. Hawking claims that he can see in higher dimensions. But dimensionality reduction is an open problem. How do you find, how do you determine in what dimension to reduce the data? Many times, if you do principal component analysis, you always concentrate or the eigenvectors corresponding to the smallest eigenvalues. But how many of them? 3, 4, 5, 6? I mean, it becomes a very complicated problem. So what I want to say here is data mining is only 20% of the effort in the whole process of data analysis. How do you get the data? How do you reduce the data or complete the data? And how do you filter the data? These are fundamental issues, and then at the end, you do the data analysis, and again, you need the expert to tell you if the patterns you obtain are meaningful or not. Okay, so there's a combination of expert and in both field science, optimization, in statistics, and also in the medical field. So we're going to deal here with a lot of microarrays here. For some of the optimization people, they don't know what are these. These are technologies that are used in a lot in biomedicine and biology. So each microarray chip consists of an array, a series of microspots called proms, each containing a very small quantity of the specific DNA sequence. Here, for example, we have an example of DNA microarray with 40,000 proms, okay? And each color dot corresponds to the amount of expression of a specifying prom. This is a very fuzzy concept, okay? And here is a typical microarray experiment, anyway, for the people in optimization who need to know that. But there is a lot of industry behind this, okay? How do you go from the experiment to the data we get as optimizers, okay? There's companies like F-Metrics, and for us, at the end, we get a numerical metrics, okay? But people, they tell us, the practitioners, it is extremely important to analyze microarrays because they contain a very large number of genes, and because of their small size, okay? Microarrays are useful when one wants to survey a large number of genes quickly, or when the sample to be studied is small, and it's used in many, many, many practical situations. I won't go much on these things here, but one of the tools we developed that is very useful to analyze microarray data is by clustering. And by clustering is nothing else but a methodology allowing for feature set and sampler test clustering simultaneously. Okay. So we do it at the same time. It finds clusters of sums possessing similar characteristics together with features creating these similarities, because features are responsible for the clustering of sums, okay? Because that's the whole idea. And the required consistency of sample and feature classification gives by clustering an advantage over other proposed methodologies that treat sums and features separately. So you see here, for example, for us, we have a matrix here, okay? We have a numerical matrix. Before by clustering, you don't see anything. It's very clear. After by clustering, you see some patterns. So something good is happening there. So it's a very simple picture that shows that from the raw data, we apply matrix by clustering, we can get this picture over here. So we see some kind of, something is going on, okay? Now, by clustering has been applied, of course, in microarray data analysis, the drug design, even in data compression. How to compress data sometimes, you can use this type of techniques. There are several applications in text mining, marketing, even dimensionality reduction, in finance, that Tom is interested there. And here I have a table that describes how the data comes in certain applications, okay? If someone has an interest to check some of the details. And already there are a few survey papers. So the field has produced a lot of exact algorithms and a lot of heuristics, and we're going to have an extra talk by Professor Fluders later on by clustering. So there is a lot of people having in mind different applications and a lot of techniques produced to attack this type of problems. Okay, so let's go now to what is this problem here. So we have a data set here, okay, says comes from microarray experiments, is a rectangular matrix here. Each column represents a data sample, can be a patient, and each row represents a feature, can be a gene, okay? And this is the matrix here. Now the numerical expression in each entry AIJ is the expression of the ith feature in the jth sample, okay? The larger the value, the larger the expression, okay? And we consider the classification of the sums to classes, S1, S2, SR, so the union of these SIs to be the whole set, and we have pairwise intersections, so the partition. And this classification has to be done so that the sums from the same class share certain common properties, okay? And then we go to the feature space, and for a feature I, we may assign to be all of the classes FIs, okay? Again, we have a partition of the feature space here. The FIs are pairwise intersected equal to empty, and the unique of the whole space. And we do this assignment, okay, in such a way that features of the class FK are responsible for creating the class of samples SK. So, in other words, by clustering, there's nothing else but a set of pairs, okay, the partition in the sample space, and the partition in the feature space, okay. And the issue is now, how can we do this, okay? Now, we'll mention there are some other techniques that attack this problem. Most of the previous approaches are local approaches, okay? Because you can see papers published in Science and Nature because they attack very important problems, okay? Because the applications are important, and it works. And many times practitioners, they use a method not because it's global. It works for the, you know, separates things in their data set. But it's not always the case, okay? If it works, you know, it's not bad. The heuristics are very good. So there are direct clustering approaches, okay? I won't go to this, some many based on statistical techniques, okay? This is Chang and Charles algorithm that is used in many times. Sometimes this problem is also called co-clustering instead of bi-clustering, okay? That's why I want to mention there are also techniques based on graph bipartitioning, because graph partitioning is an important problem. Bipartitioning, we have two classes, also general one, okay? And of course, this problem becomes a difficult NP-complete problem, but based on this formulation, we have some very nice heuristics based on spectral decomposition. So there are many types of local heuristic approaches that have been introduced to solve bi-clustering or co-clustering. Now, here's our approach, okay? I think this transparency is the idea to understand what we do here. Very simple idea. So, let us distribute, okay, the features among the classes of training sets such that each feature belongs to the class where its average expression among the training samples is the highest. We're talking about average expressions, okay? Now, if we transpose the metrics, okay, to the feature classification as given and reclassify the training samples, because we have a training set, okay, according to highest average expression values in feature classes, okay? And then you ask the question, will we obtain the same training set classification? And if yes, we say we obtain a consistent bi-clustering. Now, we need this concept of consistent bi-clustering because then we can prove a global algorithm, okay? We can prove that under this condition, we have a complete separation, okay? That's the beauty of this thing. Is that clear? Very simple idea, okay? Let's see how we can quantify this now. So based on the training set, okay? And we use average expressions, okay? We use this, you know, we can quantify this very well. We use this concepts of centers, okay? So let this sample be already assigned somehow to one of the classes 1SR. We introduce this 0-1 matrix S, okay, 0-1 matrix. And this is a classical weight how to compute these centers, okay? The kth column represents the centroid of the class SK. It's known, okay, how this can be done. Now, consider a row in the matrix C, okay? Each value in it gives us the average expression of the ith feature in one of the sampler classes. So we want to define now the checkboard, the pattern in the data. We have to assign now the feature to the class where it is most expressed, okay? To assign who is the most expressed, okay? So let us classify the I feature to the class K hat such that with the maximum value Xi hat, okay? Very simple. And again, we work now, go to the feature space, and again, we introduce this matrix 01F, and we compute again the centroid, okay? The kth column of this matrix D is the centroid of the class FK. So these are easily computed by, you know, analytically there. So the condition of on some classification, okay, we need to satisfy these conditions here. and we call. We can quantify now what we mean by this intuitive idea I told you at the beginning, what we mean by consistent by clustering. Okay. Now, not all the data admits consistent by clustering. Okay. So we call a data set is by clustering admitting if some consistent by clustering for it exists. Now, if you get a classical data set, you can always manipulate the data set. You can remove some things, you can, you know, because you have outliers, you don't know something extra about the training set, okay? And you can get, actually, we have elaborated on different types of situations here. We have, I'm not going to confuse you here, we have alpha consistent by clustering, beta consistent by clustering, and so on. But these are the basic ideas that I would like to introduce. Now, we obtained this theorem. I won't have the proof of this theorem here, but this is one of the first results that shows under what conditions consistent by clustering provides perfect separation. Okay, so B is a consistent by clustering. Okay, then we can prove that in the future, in the sample space, we have convex cones. I call them PIs. Okay, so SI belongs to the PI, and in the future space, we have convex cone. Okay, I call them QIs, and each FK belongs to some QK, okay? So, as you see in this three-dimensional example here, I have three cones, okay? And not only that, this theorem gives also the degree of the separation of the cones, okay? So it shows how separated the classes are. So under the condition of consistent by clustering, you have a perfect separation. Okay? You can prove a condition that the algorithm is global. Okay? If someone has an interest on the proof of this, we have a paper published. Actually, one of my students, Stas Bushingin, who now unfortunately works in a finance company because he wants to make money, he had worked before in a data mining company. How many of you know Stas Bushingin? I knew him before he came as a student to me because he has this famous NB completeness web page. A Ukrainian guy. Okay, let's see how can we make this as an optimization model to solve it, okay? So we talk constantly about average expressions, okay? Since we talk about average expressions, we must introduce some fractions. So we introduce these binary variables, xi, 0 and 1, okay? Is 1, xi equal to 1 if the i feature is selected, 0 otherwise. And we can enforce the condition on consistent by clustering by this strict inequality theorem. Looks complicated, but it's not complicated because you remember the entries of the matrix F are 0 and 1. Okay? If it's 0, the term disappears. If it's 1, becomes a very simple fraction. Okay? Becomes, of course, in practice, we cannot use open sets, okay? Strict inequalities. And so we have to introduce an objective function. We have a lot of freedom in these practical applications for the choice of the objective function. Okay? So we have chosen here the simplest of objective functions. We have a linear objective function here because what we want to do is we want to select the maximal possible number of features in order to lose the minimal amount of information provided by the training set. The training set is very important in these practical applications. Okay? So we don't want to lose any of this information provided by the experts. So our objective here is a linear objective function, okay? Now, we can put weights if you like, because you may consider something is more important than something else, okay? So you have a weighted linear objective, okay? But nothing will change on the complexity of the problem. So at the end, what we have here, we have a 0-1 linear objective, but non-linear fractional constraints. Okay, this is not a typical fractional zero on a problem you try to solve. Now we have this. You see, the inequalities now here are bigger or equal. Okay, I leave a lot of details out. Why this is this beta actually has to do with the degree of the separation of the cones. Characterizes how far the cones are separated. Okay. But how do we solve the issue becomes now, how do we solve such non-linear? So here, you see here now, this problem is NP-complete because of the introduction of the binary variables, okay? So how do we solve such combinatorial problems efficiently. Well, even for the support virtual machines, Steve introduced the concept of the kernel, which is called the trick, okay? Now, we use another trick here, we do linearization. Always I tell the students what is the difference between a trick and a method. Polya used to say that a method is a trick used more than once. At the beginning is always a trick, so this is not a trick now, the kernel is a method. Everybody uses it. And linearization also is a very nice technique, so what we do, we have a couple of papers actually here, actually how to treat this type of problems. We, of course, when you linearize the constraints, you have to pay attention how many new 0-1 variables you introduce, okay, because you want to control the size of the problem. And we have some very efficient ways of linearizing this constraint. So at the end we have, I don't have the details here, okay, but if someone wants to see the details, we have different ways on how to linearize this type of problems. So at the end, the problem becomes linear objective, linear constraints, binary variables. Still a very difficult problem, but at least you have commercial packages like Cplex you can apply, and still exactly you can solve these problems only up to certain dimension, okay? So then we develop some heuristics. Actually, we have a good heuristic that still the relaxed problem is an integer problem. But for some reason, we can solve very large instances with a Cplex and produces very good solutions, okay? So that's the whole... I left a lot of details out here. We have a couple of papers, if someone has an interest. Also, we apply this not only to microarray data, but to some other type of problems. We are working on epilepsy research. Okay, so this is exactly what I say here. I show you some examples now here. So for example, this method was applied to, the first is types of, different types of leukemia. Now here we have the sample sizes. I don't know if I, let me see if I have some details later on here. This is a very famous paper published in Science in 99, 10 years ago. So there is a data set containing 47 sums of AALL patients and 25 sums of AML patients, and there are about 7,000 features, if I remember well. Now in the picture, it's a huge matrix, you know. It's difficult to visualize, but you can see that by clustering, you know, it's a very large data set. It looks better in the laptop here. But our biclustering algorithm selected here 3,439 features for the class ALL and 3,242 features for the AML. Of course, it's less than 7,000 features because there is biclustering admitting this data set. And we only contained one error, okay? Now, of course, you have to compare this with other techniques, support vector machines were used here, but only after a lot of tuning. The support vector initially delivered 5 classification errors, and then no classification errors after you play around a lot to tune the algorithm, okay? The other data set I show here is from the huge index heat map. These are different parts of the human body, and you try to see which genes are defined with different parts, okay? With the lungs, with the brain, with the bone, and so on. And again, the sample, hope I don't have here. The sample, it was about it was a little larger here, if you, I don't remember the details, about 200 some, but the feature space also was about 7,000 features. And we can see here the classification, the separation very well, which features are responsible for the clustering of the samples. But of course, in many practical situations we are working now, we have a data set from the Genetics Institute in Florida that has 120,000 features. And of course, exact algorithms are impossible to attack such huge problems. Even heuristics, yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you give us some idea how to mix apples and oranges? For example, you have data from epimetric chips and you have
I don't understand your question. So you mean you have an experiment and you collect the data from, and then someone else does the same?
Yeah. Or some part of the data comes from one technology or one.
Actually, we have not done work on this. If the data comes from different, at the end we have, for us, you know, we're not experts on the experimentation. So we get the metrics, okay, and we work on the metrics. Now, if the metrics comes from a different technology, we don't care. You know, we care only if the final data set. Of course, may be an issue, you are right. That's why we have so many companies, they produce now this, if metric is one, you know. So, but I don't think, if I understand your question, it should be a main difference. Maybe someone else from the audience understands the question. I do not, yeah. So, because the data set must be the same, otherwise something,
my
yeah.
My question is, have you thought about normalization when the data comes
from? About what?
Normalization.
Yeah, we thought about some of these issues, yeah, some of the practical questions. Actually, Mario will give a talk, I think, about some normalization here. Yeah. Anyway, some of these problems are very difficult, and we applied, I don't have a transparency here. We apply this by clustering to another type of data sets. For many years, I worked for the prediction and control of epileptic seizures. So the data here is our electroencephalogram, so time series. Now, for many years, there is a device that is used for the cure of epilepsy, it's called, you know. It's the vagus nerve stimulator. It's a device that is embedded in the body, has an electrode that is connected to the vagus nerve, and giving electrical stimulations, many times in many epileptic patients stops seizures, okay? Now, this device exists. Many thousands of people, they have the device embedded in their body, but this vagus nerve goes everywhere. Goes to the brain, goes to the heart, goes to the intestines. The FDA approved this device because it works for 20% of the patients, the sample they have, without knowing why it works, okay? So it happens many times in many drugs, and approval depends on how many people it works, not because we understand the process, okay? So we use by clustering in people with seizures, data we got from people that they have seizures, and normal people, healthy people. Actually, students from my lab, they took the electroencephalograms, okay? And by clustering was the first attempt to see why this technique works. And what we found out that it did, the electrical stimulations change a biomarker that we have identified for the seizure prediction. It did change what we call the largest Lyapunov exponent of a system. The large, we cannot estimate exactly what it is, but from experimental data we can compute the largest Lyapunov exponent that characterizes the chaoticity of the system. Okay. So it's a first attempt with this by clustering technique to validate why such a vague nerve stimulator works. And of course, this also motivated us to modify this device because it stimulates the brain at regular intervals, okay? But so by if you introduce a random number generator, you can do it randomly so the brain will not anticipate this. And sometimes it trains, you know, it anticipates, it doesn't work after a couple of years. So it's a very interesting application. We have a paper that appeared actually a couple of months ago. So many interesting applications on bi-clustering. And I think Chris also is going to discuss some different applications of bi-clustering. Anyway, here there are some of the references. Someone has an interest. The first paper discusses the mathematics of this, the proof of the separation by cons, okay? And the other papers here. And I think I will stop a little earlier here. We have a conference that we're organizing next month in Hanyang if someone's interested in biomarkers. And we have a couple of books that published recently. One book is on clustering challenges of biological networks. Another one on data mining and mathematical programming gives the focus a lot on the mathematics of optimization related to data mining applications. And a couple of years ago, I published a book of optimization in medicine. So what I want to say is that the last few years, our optimizers, they have been involved heavily in many biomedical applications. So this is very new, okay? So it seems that there are so many opportunities now to be part of the solution of very grand, challenging problems in medicine, in other biomedical sciences, and optimization can be really involved in many of these problems. I think I will stop here, and I didn't go to many of the technical details, but I will entertain any questions. Yes, sir. You see, support vector machines many times work on, they are very good on binary classification. Of course, can be used if you have more classes. But from a comparison, I showed to you, if you just use a support vector machine, it will reduce a lot of errors. If you tune it a lot, you know, because there are many tuning of parameters, then in that example, it was free of errors after some. What do you mean? That was linear. Linear is linear. Yeah.
The second question is, what kind of problems or specific types of features is by clustering appropriate? Because I think the question that was asked is, this problem, you had gene expression, so it was the amount of gene expression and you had different genes.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of homogeneous features, it was not the height, the weight, kind of different kinds of features. So, what kind of problems?
I think for this for cancer data, it seems to work very well for this type of data. Of course, in the objective function, you can put weights, as I mentioned. You know, so if we know that certain features contribute more to classification, then you can put weights. But of course, how do you define the weights? Again, it's only from practical consideration. It's not a rigorous mathematical way. But you cannot consider a weighted objective function that considers this. Now, I didn't go to some details here. We have this concept of beta pi clustering that incorporates knowledge of the expert, okay? Because the expert is very important in these models, okay? Because if the expert tells you that this gene contributes more than this gene, this knowledge must be incorporated in the model. And we have a way to incorporate this in the constraints. So. Yeah, yeah.
So you don't get the optimal solution, you see. Now, you mentioned in the beginning that optimization can bring a new angle and find the best method. Could you shed some light into how optimization might be able to pick among many methods that might exist in baseline? Because, you know, this whole idea of optimization hasn't really crept into the main data mining field.
You see, in optimization, we have two classes of problems. Easy, I mean relative, because the size is a big issue, that are solved in polynomial time, and problems that are not solved in polynomial time. I mean, this question can be addressed easily to computer scientists, but to practitioners it's very difficult to explain what means it tractability, okay? But if a model is expressed as quadratic or linear, convex or non-convex, okay? In the sense that we have 0-1 variance, then we have state-of-the-art software that can solve certain classes, up to certain classes. You know, the Cplex, there are many nice packages for convex optimization, you know. But then we cope with the, instead of going to the exact solution that takes a lot of time, we develop a lot of heuristics. So that's what I mentioned, some of these papers in Science, in Nature, they apply heuristics, you know. It worked. Heuristics means they find solutions, okay? Of course, we don't have a certificate of optimality. We don't know that we got, you know, how good is the solution or whatever. So if the model introduces binary variables, to solve it exactly, is intractable in some sense. Then you cope with the introduction of some heuristics. And that's what we did here. So we apply some heuristics. Now, to find a good heuristic needs a lot of effort. I mean, experimentation and to see which one works. So we can do that. I mean, so I think the last few years, optimization now contributed a lot to this field data mining. Yes, Chris?
There are many comparative studies of optimization-based methods for clustering and microclustering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many survey papers. Yeah. The last 10 years, there's a lot of course, the communities are still disconnected. That's why we did this workshop here, other workshops. We bring together, you know, 15 years ago, you won't see any book, for example, optimization data mining. The classical journals, you know, for statistics journals to publish, you know, results in data mining. Now you see a lot of effort in from the optimization community. I think that's what in my first introduction to transparency, I saw the optimization and data mining together. If you optimize the process, and of course, all the combination of, you can do much better ways. Optimization can help a lot to many of these things. Selection problems are very simple. Yeah. Of course, uncertainty comes in the noisiness of the data. Right. Data, and always many times you make assumptions that the noise is Gaussian or is not Gaussian, but these are assumptions are, you know, for convenience. But definitely there is a lot of issue of noise in the data. But medicine is not an exact science, you know. It's like weather forecasting, you know. You don't. The data is collected by humans, by machines, so error is reduced. That's an issue. It's an issue.
In finance, sometimes people argue against
optimization. Yeah. Especially finance, for example, removing outliers can be very dangerous because an outlier may be the most important thing in finance. If someone has inside information, you remove him. So what is an outlier depends also on the application, so.
At the beginning of your talk, you talked about massive data sets.
Yes.
But during the talk, I didn't see massive data sets to optimize
I did not mention, I say this is a new challenging area. I did not mention anything about. Only the last few years, people address issues on how to compute with massive data sets. Yeah, online type of algorithm is also one way to depends, you know, on also depends on your data representation. The data can be represented as a matrix, you see, we have here, but can be represented as a network, can be represented as an image. So the data representation is very crucial, you know. For example, we analyze the call graph with a network, you know, then we can enter the data in a pair of edges, you know. But this is not always possible. Sometimes you have to do the, you know, you have to think differently when you have to do with external memory algorithms. Because the data is here. You must go back and forth to take another disk, another. So it depends on the application. And it depends on the data representation. If it's a numerical, you know, here we have metrics data, okay? Then we can use numerical analysis techniques, you know, use eigenvalues. If your data is a network data, say a neural network in the brain, then you use a lot of network techniques, ideas, you know. If it's image, it's different. If it's EDG data, time series techniques and so on. But for massive data sets, we have new challenges. Say, think about the simple problem. How do you sort the data if it's massive? If it fits in the computer, you have optimal n log n algorithms, if you have n records. But what about if you have a disk? Or a room, all of this becomes a much more complicated problem. Also, the computer architectures now influence the analysis of the data. You must have input, output in parallel, and different computer architectures. Because the data becomes so huge now that we need to go to the next step on how to optimize with massive data sets.
Do you think people have talked about the idea that
Now there are conferences now, the last couple of years, on external massive data sets or external memory algorithms. But it's a very new field that people start addressing questions and they see the challenges, you know. Because everybody collects data. We are in an age of data collection, you know. Imagine the satellites, how much data they send every day. The government, how much data they collect for many things, you know. The weather data, other data, finance data, massive amount of data. I mean, it's an amazing way. That's why people say that we have a lot of information, but no knowledge. And how do we extract knowledge out of this? Well, I think we just enough time for the coffee break, eh? Thank you. Πώς πήγαμε, καλά. Πάμε και το κεφάλι μου. Τσακαλείς τώρα που δείξει. Τσακαλείς. Ναι. Το κρατήσω πλέον. Καλά πήγαμε, ζήτημα.